Hello, I'm Michael Sheriffs, and welcome to Creative Instinct, with the final in our series, Who is Germany? Now, while much of the identity of modern Germany has revolved around reflections and re-examinations of recent history, a parallel strand of self-determination for the country has been a story of innovation, excellence, and counter-historical levels of global collaboration. But while the big engine of this has been in manufacturing, another very clever industry has changed the way the world makes music. It grew out of the odd inventiveness of bands like Kraftwerk and out of the Berlin club scene that we heard about last week. And this music culture is not to be underestimated, because a particularly German mindset produced myriad companies creating software that liberated musicians and composers from the expensive limitations of hardware.
Daniel Haver, CEO of Native Instruments.
Marta Garlick, CTO of Native Instruments.
Native Instruments are not some ethnomusicological repository. They were, in fact, one of the first companies to see the potential of computers in music and begin to emulate real instruments in software, invent new instruments in software, and reproduce entire and utterly convincing orchestral and acoustic ensembles, all using software instruments.
With the heritage of Kraftwerk and basically everything afterwards in electronic music, and the strong interest in progressing that music and people being part of a certain culture, which was also happening during that time, which was techno music, which is also something that was really started to a large degree in Berlin, things came together. And then with something like the computer suddenly becoming something much more than just a typewriter, it was just a perfect place to be. And I mean, us, we were dancing in the same kind of clubs as the Ableton guys, who were also producing music back in the days. A couple of us guys producing music or being DJs as well. So it was just certain things came together.
So there was a very clear climate in Berlin of a whole lot of people just in that right moment trying to liberate themselves and trying to sort of come up with a new way of behaving, a new way of creating.
I believe there is a very strong sense in Germany, and especially in its capital, when it comes to technology and music. This is two things that in Germany go very well together, you know, and especially computer environments. I mean, Germans invented the computer, or a German did back in the day. And we have a long history in both arenas, and to combine it was only natural because there's a lot of talent in this country. And again, in its main city, that created an environment that such products had to come out of it.
Yeah, I think there was a revolution happening here in the 90s. And if you are a musician who is about to progress and who wants to redefine how music sounds, you are automatically technically minded, at least in that time. And suddenly people who are not professionally trained musicians or who have a lot of money could experiment with creative possibilities that were not available before. And it was like a chain reaction. You know, it started in a very small space of nerds, people who are kind of musically driven, but actually already very technical. And from this use case, it has grown into something much larger and basically have redefined in the music space in the way how music is being produced and performed.
So how competitive is this arena now? Because there are a lot of companies out there doing not exactly what you're doing, but similar things parallel. Do you need that competition to keep you focused?
We don't necessarily need the competition for it. What they make us do is do it faster. This is the main thing that the competition does to us. They give us a little bit of inspiration to maybe get straighten out things sometimes. Yeah, that element is there, I won't deny it, but it's not the key component because, again, the pressure comes more with others copying us, learning from us, and if we then are not already again, haven't done the next step, then things get tighter.
However, the real grunt of the German economy has been and remains, for the time being at least, in traditional, albeit very progressive, manufacturing.
Yeah, my name is Thomas Esch. I'm here professor at the University of Applied Sciences, and I'm the head of the Institute for Thermodynamics and Combustion Engineering.
So why do you think German industry has been so successful even through the difficult times?
Yeah, the German government puts a lot of money into the education because we don't have any natural resources here, so we cannot sell any coal or oil or something like this. So what we can only sell is the products of our engineering capacity. And education is important in Germany, and education from universities, of course. And that is one of the success of the high export rate which Germany offers.
This emphasis on education and on strong skills training caught the eye of a young Australian labour man, Bob Carr, back in the 1970s.
One part of German culture is the emphasis that they've got on skills development. When I went there and was so enchanted by it in the 1970s, I and colleagues looked at co-determination, Mitbestimmung, that is, worker representation on the boards of German companies or the involvement of the works councils. We were looking at the wrong thing. The thing that made their industry competitive was the attention to skills development. We should have been looking in more detail at their apprenticeship system, an apprenticeship for every trade. Every trade, for every job, there's an apprenticeship. Their focus on lifting the skills, on tending to the skills of their workforce, I think has given them a competitive edge, and I think that needs to be attended to more.
One of the mainstays of German manufacturing has, of course, been the car industry, with premium German marks continuing to hold high status, even in the explosive economies of Asia. And a perfect example of a car brand that has continued to stay ahead of the game and of economic pits that have swallowed so many other motoring giants has been BMW. So I visited their Munich plant and sat down with one of the head honchos of their BMW I division. It's the division that's aiming to reposition the company at the head of the sustainability pack.
My name is Manuel Zettig. We're right now at the BMW headquarters in Munich, and I'm responsible for the communication of Project I, which has been the basis, the think tank, which brought up a brand and products such as BMW I, our BMW i3 and i8 concepts.
There are a lot of automotive manufacturers that are working very hard on exactly this. They're trying to find the new paradigm for a car, a new paradigm for how cars work in an urban environment. So you're not alone in doing that. So what does that do in terms of the way you engage as a company? Because BMW seems to be very good at collaborations, not just with other corporations, but with universities. Is that the way a company in this era has to work?
Yeah, absolutely. Adding new concepts, new ideas, and new services to our original business models means you have to also find new partners. And as you already mentioned, universities have had a long tradition in partnerships with BMW, and this is extended to a specific way. Looking back at the Mini E project, for example, when we started in the year 2009, we ran the Mini E as a test fleet of around 600 cars in countries worldwide.
So these are electric mini miners.
Electric mini models, which have only been test models. We produced 600 cars to find out how customers would behave while driving an electric car. So to actually find out what people need while driving an electric car. And what's striking about that project is that we, in every country, we launched the Mini E for a specific test drive. We integrated every partner that has a stake in electromobility. We integrated the governmental side. We integrated energy and infrastructure companies, real customers. We didn't have only BMW engineers driving the cars, we want real customers. And we integrated as a research partner university in each of those countries. So by bringing everyone who has a stake in electromobility to the table and supporting, having a support on scientific research by universities, you actually make it very transparent, very clear what electromobility needs for everyone who has a stake or everyone who plays that game.
Do you feel that this is a significant characteristic of German thinking? Because it seems like not just BMW, companies like Siemens and Bosch, there are a lot of technology companies that are changing the way they operate and seem to be quite trusting of the future.
I mean, I certainly think that we in Germany have a very long tradition of working in internationally, looking at how many different countries German companies are producing, for example. We are not producing all of our goods in Germany and then export it. Some of our goods are produced locally for that specific reasons or specific demands in the market. So this has a very long German tradition. But I would say specifically for BMW, this is, you have to accept that the world is changing. You have to, I mean, everyone says, yeah, the world is changing, but the striking thing is, yes, the world is changing.
What does that do to the products? You are involved, as we said, not just in the cars themselves, but mobility thinking. And I imagine that you are talking to cities and the way cities, new cities, are developing, you know, in public policy, in urban planning. I mean, is that also the thing that you need to be involved in, those bigger conversations?
It is very important, especially for electromobility, to have stakes in the development of infrastructure, of course. If you would look back at combustion engine cars and how you would refill your cars at a gas station, you would never actually think that the car company has any obligation or anything to do with how you fill up your car. The game completely changes with electromobility. People think, you cannot just sell me an electric car. You have to guide me through how I'm going to manage electromobility, because there are so many uncertainties yet at this point for customers. So the game actually changed. And by doing that, in order to provide the best solution and the best situation for the customer to really make electromobility hit off, or any other forms of future alternative drivetrain solutions, you have to talk with people who have all the stakes in electromobility. That is, of course, how cities going to be developed. You have to keep a close contact to people, to governments, to city planners, to mayors, but also to companies who are building up infrastructure, like energy companies, to make that work. If you would cut that rope, electromobility would not be as successful as we see it in all the corporations with everyone we work together with.
Of course, innovation comes in many forms, and one of the most striking aspects of Germany is the way it keeps having to deal with the complexities of difficult transition. Now, it's not alone in this, but there's a directness with which it seems to face incredibly confronting issues within its own universe. For example, the triumphalism from the West at the end of the Cold War hid what was for many a far more complicated reality. Just as not everything in the West was perfect, not everything about life in East Germany was intolerable. Petra Preis is a classical musician who grew up in East Berlin, and she still lives close to the old border with her Australian partner, composer Tim Florence.
So, of course, the world is much more open now for me and for all of us. What means, especially for me, that I can get all this, especially older music, what I could not, because we had not these libraries like I have now, especially in Berlin. And I can do music with much more people, what I found here, and I can listen to more music. So, yes, for me, it's the world is much more open.
Petra's parents actually just lived down the road, but since Kreuzberg was the old dividing line with the east, if we drive down our street and keep going, there comes the old border, and we drive a bit further and we come to the house in which Petra grew up, which is actually not very far away in Treptow.
What about for people of your generation and of your parents' generation? Because I know of one friend whose parents were very well employed, very highly respected in the east, and when the wall fell, they lost their jobs, and the pensions that they had worked their whole life for became worthless. So they went from being well-respected members of the society to having no real place in the new Germany, and all the wealth, all this of security for the future had gone. How common is that?
I think these problems are discussed much more in the East German parts, not in the West. I think these are problems, they are not so, nicht so gern gehört.
They're not gladly heard about. Yeah, people people don't want to listen to them, yeah, but they're certainly there. Yeah.
Dealing with these sorts of complexities requires a particularly nuanced level of social innovation. This is powerfully evident in a small area of Berlin around Bernauerstrasse, on the border between Mitte and Wedding. It centres around the Chapel of Reconciliation, a modest little church with a big Cold War history.
Yeah, so, my name is Manfred Fischer, and I'm a Pfarrer in the Chapel of Reconciliation in Berlin. When the wall was built, it followed the lines of the borders of the old districts. And so there was a border between the district of Center Berlin and Wedding. And it normally it is in the middle of the street, but there they made it along the front of the houses. So the houses were on Center District, and the pavement and the street was Wedding District. And then in 1961, when the wall was built, and this wall followed the districts, so it ended up that the people living on the on one side of the street came to another world, but the street in front of them are already on this other world. And this is a very special situation, because how can you build a wall between the front of the house and the pavement before? There is no space for building a wall. So this street was very special when the wall was built. What they did was they closed with bricks the door. But then you could just jump out of the window. And if you jump, you are already in the west. You are already off the other side. So then they closed the windows. And therefore, this street was so well known, because you just could stay and look and take photographs of people who try to get out. So this is it became a very famous street for something which was all over in Berlin. But it was so extreme in this street. And, then they put out the people, and then they destroyed the houses. The only building which was left was our church. And it was called the Church of Reconciliation.
In the beginning, many people escaped in broad daylight by jumping out of windows facing the western sector of the city. Our firemen were there to help. We remember the woman being held by communist guards to prevent her from joining her family. They even threw tear gas at those who were below, ready to catch her. That's when they decided to extend the wall and cut access to the buildings facing West Berlin. They sealed every window.
So this street was so extreme and so famous because we had this special situation, and the wall was just the front of the houses.
And you said the church...
Well, when all the houses were destroyed, all the people were thrown out and the houses were destroyed, then the church was the only building left. And it was a church in the middle of a death strip, and the wall before and behind, and the name was Reconciliation. So this was a very symbolic thing, although it was not built as a symbol. It became a symbol. This is a very important thing for the whole story of the parish, because we always became something which we didn't want to become. It happened. For me, I never thought that, even in summer 1989, I thought it is really impossible that this change will come. Because right in the summer, we saw in TV, we saw this Chinese tragedy.
This is Tiananmen Square.
Right. And that if people stand up, these systems always strike back. And then the tanks is the answer. And this happened in all the years in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, in Berlin before in the 50s. And so this is always the answer. And what is Berlin? Berlin is a city full of destructive energy. The 20th century for Germany is terrible, and Germany was terrible for Europe. So that in Berlin will happen such a thing like a peaceful revolution. It's, you couldn't expect this. And you couldn't even, I thought we couldn't hope this as Germans.
Sadly, the original church, marooned in between the two sides of the Berlin Wall, was destroyed in 1985, only 4 years before the wall itself came down. This left the Reverend Fischer and his congregation with a dilemma. What to do next? Well, what they did achieve was amazing. A modest new chapel on the site of the old church, built from the rubble of the old church and set in a field of rye. All of this in the old death strip in the centre of Berlin. But like the reality of unification, the rebirth of this parish was not without its problems.
And so you will succeed somehow, and somehow you will fail. And the moments of failing are oftentimes the starting point for the real solution. So we failed to get money, so we found clay. So we failed to have so much people who followed us, so we find the good size, only 100 people. The old church had 1,000 places. But at the end, now we have 1 million visitors, and it shows that this could be very interesting for a lot of people. So you do something with a minimum on energy and resources, just to have enough brain energy that you can avoid to use too much oil energy. And therefore we have in this chapel, we have no heating. It's just a sculpture where you can go in and out and can go in and pray. So this is the Chapel of Reconciliation as a statement for a minimal use on resources. And this is important for mankind, I think.
The Reverend Manfred Fischer, speaking to me in his office on Bernau-Strasse, looking out across the Berlin Wall memorial space. And that's the final in the series, Who is Germany? As well as thanking the Goethe Institute and the German Foreign Office for making this series possible, I'd also like to thank my three very smart and engaged guides, for whom nothing was too difficult, Katharina Daun, Annette Diepenbrock, and Ariana Pals. And Ariana was also my translator in Program 2. And I'd especially like to thank the two women in the Goethe Institute's Berlin office who aided and abetted me in my crazy schedule, Nisha Anders and Frederica Sass. For more information, images, links, and details of my other guests, just go to the website abc.net.au/radionational
and follow the links to Creative Instinct, where you'll find a special feature page for all three programs. I'm Michael Sheriffs. Thanks for your company.
Hi, it's Michael Cathcart here, inviting you to join me for Books and Arts Daily. Throughout the week, we talk to writers and artists from Australia and right around the world. This past week, you'll meet the Scottish crime writer Ian Rankin and America's A.M. Holmes with her fabulous new novel. They're both on Books and Arts, and you can encounter them right here at the Radio National website.